Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world. Today on the program, you will hear stories from Christopher Jones Cruz, Anna Mateo, and Phil Dierking. Later, Steve Ember will bring us a special Making of a Nation report. But first, here is Christopher Jones Cruz.
Social media use has risen sharply in Cameroon, as have the government's efforts to control it. Our story begins at a church in Limbe, in southwestern Cameroon. These church members are praying for three men. A military court ruled against the three earlier this month. The men were arrested after they reportedly shared a joke about a membership campaign for the Boko Haram terrorist group on social media. The trial was not open to the public. The rights group Amnesty International and local rights activists condemned the court's ruling. Tabot Timothy is a 22-year-old law student at the University of Douala, Cameroon. He joined others at the religious center one day recently to protest the ruling.
It was just normal for a thorough investigation to be carried out to really ascertain the fact that these guys were joking. It is unjust. Thorough investigations were not carried out.
The government has used several laws to limit mobile and online communication, including an anti-terrorism law passed in 2014. Barrister George Marcelin Chungi is with the Cameroon Bar Council. He says people who use social media to spread unproven information can be sentenced to between 6 months and 2 years in prison and fined $10,000 to $20,000. He says the punishments can be twice those amounts if a court rules that the communications were designed to cause unrest. Police detained a journalist in January after he incorrectly reported on social media that President Paul Biya had visited soldiers in Cameroon's north. In March, police arrested people accused of sharing a letter from the country's Minister of Defense on social media. The letter was released without the minister's permission. It said that Boko Haram members had arrived in the capital, Yaoundé. The National Communications Council has the power to stop reporters from working and close media businesses. It is investigating 20 complaints made by top government officials. One of the reports is about a minister who was seen on Facebook dancing to the music of Fanko, a singer whose songs are banned by the government. Yet social media and mobile messaging apps and networking sites are increasingly popular in Cameroon. In fact, they are used by both opponents and supporters of the government. Nelson Tawe has examined the spread of social media in Cameroon.
Social media is inevitable. It's like a devil that you are called upon to live with. It's difficult to suppress it. It's just going to be like throwing water on the duck's back. Social media has come to stay. There's no way you can suppress it. I think that government will have an uphill task to succeed in what it's trying to do.
Several other African countries have taken actions against people who use social media in ways governments believe are illegal. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
China Labor Watch is an activist group based in New York. The group studies labor conditions in China's toy industry. In a recent report, the group wrote, "The world of toys is a heaven for children, but it may be a world of misery for toy factory workers." China Labor Watch released the report this month. It tells about working conditions in four toy factories in southern China's Guangdong province.
Investigators say the workers are paid wages of $300 or less per month for 174 hours of work. China Labor Watch says the employees often work in dangerous conditions and are not well trained. The group says the average working hours in these four factories are 11 hours a day, with more than 50 overtime hours a month. Overtime is time worked in addition to regular working hours. The group said overtime totals were as high as 130 hours in some factories. Chinese laws say employees may not work more than 8 hours a day. The report says employees sometimes worked 11 hours in a day with only a 40 to 60 minute lunch break. It said this is a clear violation of the right of workers to have adequate rest. The report says factory managers regularly asked workers to sign voluntary overtime agreements. These agreements permit the factory to violate labor laws and regulations without fear they will be punished.
Because the pay is so poor, almost all of the employees volunteer to work additional hours. The 2016 minimum wage in the cities of Dongguan and Foshan is $223 per month, while the minimum wage in Shenzhen is $300 per month. The four factories examined by China Labor Watch are in those cities. Workers at the factories earn about 5% more than the minimum wage.
Like many toy exporters in China, the factories China Labor Watch investigated have been examined by the International Toy Association. They are part of a program called ICTI Care, a 10-year-old program that says its goal is to protect toy factory workers. Mark Robinson is a spokesman for ICTI Care. He said the project does most of its work in China. He said it has examined more than 1,200 toy factories in the country. He says conditions in the factories are better than they have ever been.
But the China Labor Watch report said the ICTI standards violate China's own labor rules. Li Qiang, executive director of China Labor Watch, told VOA that ICTI is an association which permits factory workers to work 72 hours a week and even 78 hours while the factory has to fill an order. Li began investigating southern China's toy factories as an undercover laborer in 1999. He said there have been small improvements, but the overall environment for the toy industry has not improved.
China Labor Watch researchers say companies that operate the factories can raise wages and improve conditions and still be profitable. But they say most companies choose not to do so.
A new American weather satellite could save more lives by better predicting extreme weather conditions. The satellite was launched from Cape Canaveral in the state of Florida on November 19th. It will be in orbit some 36,000 kilometers above Earth's surface. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, also known as NOAA, has been working with the National Aeronautics and Space Administration on the project. NOAA officials are calling the new satellite GOES-R. This is short for a much longer name, the Geostationary Operational Environmental Satellite, R-Series. NOAA said GOES-R could improve the nation's ability to observe weather conditions and make weather predictions. It said the satellite's deployment would lead to more exact and timely weather forecasts, watches, and warnings. The government agency said the satellite will require testing of its 6 instruments and will be ready to work within a year. The next generation of weather satellites is finally here, said NOAA Administrator Catherine Sullivan. She described GOES-R as one of the most sophisticated Earth-observing machines ever created. Sullivan said its instruments will be able to study Earth 5 times faster and with 4 times more detail than any other NOAA satellite currently in operation. She believes this will make the United States an even stronger, more weather-ready nation. A NOAA statement said the greater detail will help improve the agency's study of ocean storms, as well as the prediction and warnings of severe weather. In addition, GOES-R will be able to provide improved rainfall estimates, which will lead to more timely and detailed flood warnings. The statement also said that GOES-R will give better estimates of wind strength, as well as better measurement of fog, ice, or lightning strikes. One of the 6 instruments on the satellite is designed to help scientists study lightning strikes and map them. This, NOAA says, will help the agency follow the movement of severe storms and provide more detailed warnings. Craig Fugate serves as administrator of the Federal Emergency Management Agency. He says that the GOES-R satellite will improve the ability of people and organizations across America to prepare for and react to weather-related disasters. Fugate feels that better understanding of the world around us will lead to better results. These include knowing where to best position supplies before a storm hits and providing more targeted information to local officials. That information could help the officials decide when to order civilians to leave an area because of bad weather. In addition to weather forecasting, GOES-R will be part of an international search and rescue network. It will have a special transponder that will be able to find signals from emergency beacons. I'm Phil Dierking.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. The Second World War ended with the surrender of Japan in August 1945. Americans looked to their new president, Harry Truman, to lead them into a new time of peace. Truman was vice president until President Franklin Roosevelt died suddenly in the closing months of the war. Almost no one expected President Truman to be as strong a leader as Roosevelt had been. And at first, they were right. Truman had one problem after another during his first months in the White House. Truman's first big problem was the economy. Almost 2 million Americans lost their jobs as factories ended wartime production. Americans everywhere worried about what would happen next. Only a few years before, the nation had suffered through the worst economic crisis in its history. No one wanted to return to the closed banks, hungry children, and other sad memories of the Great Depression. In some ways, the economy did better after the war than many experts had predicted. Many Americans still had money they had saved during the war, and Congress passed a law designed to help people keep their jobs. The situation could have been much worse than it was. However, the economy could also have been better, much better. Almost overnight, the price of almost everything began to rise. President Truman tried to stop the increases through a special price control agency that had been created during the war. However, thousands of business people refused to follow the government price control rules. Instead, they set their own prices for goods. Store owners would tell government officials that they were obeying the price controls, but often they charged whatever they wanted for the goods they sold. Businesses were not the only ones who were refusing to obey government price controls. Organized labor did the same thing. President Truman had always been a friend of labor unions, but during the first months of his administration, he became involved in a fierce struggle with coal miners and railroad workers. The first sign of trouble came in September 1945. A group of auto workers closed down factories at the Ford Motor Company. Then, workers at General Motors went on strike. Soon, there were strikes everywhere. The oil industry, the clothing industry, the electrical industry, and more. The strikes made Truman angry. He believed the striking workers were threatening the economy and security of the United States. He became even angrier when union representatives came to the White House and refused to accept a compromise wage offer. Truman ordered the army to take over the railroads and the coal mines. Within a short time, the striking coal miners returned to work. However, the president had less success with the railroad workers. He became so angry with the unions representing them that he asked Congress to give him the power to draft all striking railroad workers into the armed forces. The rail strike finally ended, but millions of Americans lost faith in Truman's ability to lead the country and to bring people together. By late 1946, most Americans believed that the man in the White House did not know what he was doing. Truman seemed weak and unable to control events. Union members disliked him because of his strong opposition to the coal and rail strikes. Farmers opposed Truman because of the administration's effort to keep meat prices low. Conservatives did not trust the reforms that Truman promised in his speeches, and liberal Democrats watched with concern as many of Franklin Roosevelt's old advisors left the government because they could not work with Truman. In November of 1946, the people voted in congressional and state elections. The results showed they were not satisfied with Truman and his Democratic Party. Republicans won control of both houses of Congress for the first time in 18 years, and Republicans were elected governor in 25 states. The election was a serious defeat for the Democrats, but a disaster for Truman. Some members of his party even called on him to resign. Few people gave Truman much chance of winning the next presidential election in 1948. However, Harry Truman began to change in the months that followed the 1946 congressional elections. He became a stronger speaker. He showed more understanding of the powers of the presidency. And in matters of foreign policy, he began to act more presidential. This was especially so in Truman's reaction to Soviet aggression in Germany. Truman wanted to rebuild Germany as well as the other war-torn countries of Western Europe. As we heard last week, his administration worked closely with Western European leaders to rescue their broken economies through the Marshall Plan. But the Soviets did not want to see Germany rebuild, at least not so quickly. At first, they flooded Germany with extra German currency in an effort to destroy its value. They walked out of economic conferences. And finally, in early 1948, they blocked all the roads to West Berlin. West Berlin was in communist East Germany, but not under communist control, as was East Berlin. After the war, the Allies had divided Germany in half. West Germany had a democratic government. East Germany was communist, under Soviet control. The Soviet actions in Berlin were a direct threat to the West. Truman had three difficult choices. If he did nothing, the world would think the United States was weak and unable to stop Soviet aggression. If he fought the blockade with force, he might start a third world war. But there was another choice. The Allies proposed the idea of flying tons of food, fuel, and other supplies into West Berlin. Not just once, but every day, as long as the Russians continued their blockade. It would be a difficult job. West Berlin was home to 2.5 million people. No one had ever tried to supply so large a city by air. Planes would have to take off every 3.5 minutes, day and night, to supply the people with enough food, medicine, clothing, and badly needed coal. The operation involved American C-47 and larger C-54 transport planes, along with British Lancaster, York, and Hastings aircraft. On June 26th, the first C-47s landed at Tempelhof Airport, the beginning of the great operation that was to come. Plans called for the operation to last just a few weeks. The planes landed in the blockaded city, and local volunteers provided support on the ground. Former mechanics of the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force, joined Americans in servicing the aircraft. More than 20,000 Berliners worked day and night to build an additional landing field for the American and British planes. It became Tegel, now Berlin's major airport. As part of the supply effort, the British Royal Air Force even landed Sunderland flying boats on a Berlin lake. Brigadier General Joseph Smith was appointed task force commander of the American part of the airlift. General Smith called the mission Operation Vittles, using an American slang term for food. Operation Vittles also led to Operation Little Vittles, or the dropping of chocolates and other treats to children. The pilots who did this became known as candy bombers. Appreciative German children called them die Schokoladenflieger, the chocolate pilots.
They wanted to know which airplane I was in. I said, you tell my airplane on regular wings, and then you'd know that's me. Watch just that airplane. And they says, good, that's Lindenborg. I came back the next day, and I put little parachutes for the Galgumi and the Chocoladen so they could see it. And so it would hit them hard in the head, slow it down. And so I wiggled the wings, and boy, they waved their hands, and I pushed it out of the airplane. And that's how it started.
It was the idea of Gail Halverson, a pilot in the United States Air Force. Lieutenant Halverson became known as Mr. Wiggly Wings. From his plane, he would drop chewing gum and chocolates attached to tiny parachutes made from handkerchiefs. Soon, many of the airlift pilots were dropping candy from their planes, including into Soviet-controlled areas that they flew over. Americans back home supplied the handkerchiefs, and the chocolate industry supplied the treats. Years later, in Berlin, Gail Halverson told German interviewer Rolf Gründer how he got the idea.
I dropped chocolate because of gratitude. I met 30 children at the fence at Tempelhof, and not one put out their hands and says, give me more than flour, give me more than coal, give me chocolate. And they had no chocolate, they had no gum, but they would not be a beggar. They're so grateful for flour. And I said, wow. They were thankful. And when people are thankful, good things happen.
It soon became clear to the Soviets that the Berlin airlift would succeed. In May of 1949, almost 1 year after they had started their blockade, they ended it. The crisis in Berlin changed the way many Americans saw their president. Harry Truman no longer seemed so weak or unsure of himself. Instead, he was acting as a leader who could take an active part in world affairs. Truman's popularity increased. However, most Americans did not expect him to win the election in 1948. Almost everyone believed that the Republican candidate, New York Governor Thomas Dewey, would capture the office. The election campaign that year turned out to be one of the most exciting and surprising in the history of the nation. That will be our story next week.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.